The following is For Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Mark Garber, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Border battle American style over immigrant kids seeking a better life, with Republicans attacking Obama for what he is and isn't doing, and vice versa.
Border battle Mideast style. Israeli teens kidnapped and killed. A Palestinian boy burned alive. Escalating air attacks and fear of a new ground war.
Contraception before and beyond the high court. Political fallout from the Hobby Lobby decision. Voting rights challenges and more gay marriage wins.
Threats to and from the internet. A new survey of experts outlines the challenges for privacy, security, commerce, and communications.
Celebrating Fred and Ginger, Astaire and Rogers, if you really need last names, songs and stories of the great dance duo from the golden era of black and white.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for Your Ears Only, now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For Your Ears Only, for the week of July 13th and Bastille Day, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Mark Garber. Quote from the news, "What's most important for me is bringing one trophy back to Northeast Ohio." That was basketball great LeBron James announcing his return to the Cleveland Cavaliers 4 years after a heartbreaking, fury-fueling departure to play for the Miami Heat. Also last week, Republicans chose Cleveland for their 2016 convention. Now this.
The problem here is not a major disagreement around the actions that could be helpful in dealing with the problem. The challenge is Congress prepared to act to put the resources in place to get this done?
This is a problem of the president's own making. He's been president for 5.5 years. When's he going to take responsibility for something?
Sue him. Impeach him. Really? Really? For what? You're going to sue me for doing my job?
Terms of the nation's never-ending debate on immigration keep changing. Sometimes it's about foreigners gorging on welfare. Other times they're stealing jobs. Not long ago they were a security threat. Just now they represent an unprecedented humanitarian crisis on our border. Tens of thousands of Central American children, unaccompanied or with parents, overwhelming federal resources, outraging many local residents and their elected officials. House Speaker John Boehner and other Republicans blame President Obama for a lack of leadership on the problem, insufficient security measures and policies on the undocumented that invite the influx.
In fact, it's a Bush-era law that requires court hearings for youngsters fleeing violence or sex trafficking in countries south of Mexico. And Boehner was initially hostile to Obama's action request for nearly $4 billion to finance more efficient deportation proceedings, more humane detention facilities in the meanwhile, and additional border security. Interestingly, though, Boehner's long-threatened lawsuit against the president, finally detailed last week, focused not on the immigration mess at all, but executive action delaying parts of Obamacare, which many Republicans would like to repeal altogether. To consider all these aspects of policy and politics for Your Ears Only, we're joined now by Boston Globe columnist Jeff Jacoby. Welcome to the program.
Good to talk to you.
Let's start with the argument that immigrants steal jobs from Americans at a time when the economy is still struggling back to normal. There was a think tank report suggesting that all the new jobs recently created have gone to the foreign-born. But you note some major flaws.
It's one of the oldest complaints in American history. I suppose that that 10 years after the Mayflower came, whoever arrived on the next boat were prompting complaints that they were taking away jobs from the original pilgrims. The thrust of this report from the Center for Immigration Studies, which is a nativist anti-immigration organization, and which openly calls for reduction in all immigration. This isn't just about opposition to illegal immigration. Their argument is that since the year 2000, over the past 14 years, there's been a net increase of something like 6 million new jobs in this country, but that when you look at the figures and break them down by native-born Americans and immigrant Americans, the entire increase has all gone to those who are foreign-born. So I wrote a column looking at this a little bit more closely. As you mentioned, one of the things left out of this, you had to go to a footnote, you know, way back on page 17 in the report, down in the fine print. They acknowledge that, in fact, the number of jobs going to native-born Americans has increased by millions. Something like 2.5 or 2.6 million over the past 14 years. The reason that they don't include this in their figures is because there's been an enormous increase in the number of workers who are 65 and older, which is one of the fastest growing age groups in the workforce today. So that's one piece of it. Just statistically, they play around a little bit with the numbers. There are real differences, though, one of which, I'll just mention 2 points. We could spend the whole show talking about just this. But two quick points. One is that immigrants, almost by definition, are self-selected for mobility. They're more likely to go where work is available. They're more likely to direct themselves to pick up more quickly, to go find a job, and to leave a place where there's less employment and go someplace where there's more. For many native-born Americans, there are often local ties that make that harder to do. But beyond all of that, over and above all the rest of that, is the fact that this is zero-sum thinking, which has never been accurate. It's never been a good picture of the way immigrants affect the American economy. Immigrants fill jobs that they find waiting to be filled. They also create jobs. They launch companies. They hire people. There are all kinds of statistics about the number of businesses launched in this country by immigrants and by the children of immigrants. If we were to subtract the immigrant contribution, even of immigrants alive now, not going back 200 years, but just those who are currently in the workforce now, subtract everything that they've added to this economy and all the native-born Americans that they employ and all the wealth that they generate and that they create, we would be far more impoverished than we are.
Given the crisis we see on the border now, though, should the Bush-era law be changed to close the unanticipated loophole that so many underage Central Americans are now persuaded to exploit, or are more resources to process them in or out a sufficient answer?
To the extent that the law fills the need that it was created for, I wouldn't want to repeal that. I wouldn't want to send a kid back if there's a danger that he's going to be killed or that he's going to be or he or she are going to be forced into sex slavery. I wouldn't be surprised, though, if that becomes part of the deal that makes it possible for something to happen.
Another part of the deal might be the suggestion that Obama's promise to shift more existing resources from inland to the border could mean fewer deportations of those already living here undocumented, as demanded by so many Latinos who are now questioning their traditional ties to the Democratic Party.
It's a funny thing. My politics are, they lean right of center. I tend to be a free market conservative on most things. I've never understood the hostility to immigrants or the demand that they be rounded up and deported. I remember when it was people on my side of the aisle on most issues who were furious with the Clinton administration for sending Elian Gonzalez back to Cuba, whereas many liberals were saying, well, that was just enforcing the rule of law and that's what has to be done. Now it seems as though in this situation the reactions are flipped. And you have many people, not only Latino, but many on the left, many liberals, many Democrats who are concerned about the thought of sending anyone back. And you've got conservatives who are screaming and yelling and clamoring for a fence to be put up on the border for 3,000 miles. And there's so much emotion that comes into this issue, and it seems to drive out common sense. The Obama administration, for all that Republicans and conservatives have been opposed to, has deported more illegal immigrants than any previous administration. Many Latinos have been calling Obama the deporter-in-chief because of the huge numbers. $18 billion a year have been spent under this administration on border and immigration enforcement, which is something like 15 times as much what the government was spending back when Ronald Reagan was president, at the time that that conservatives look back to as the halcyon days. I've thought for the longest time that it's the quota system that we have, which is based on abstract or arbitrary numbers rather than on rational reasons for either wanting people or not wanting people, that's at the root of this whole thing. And until we get that fixed, we're going to keep having these periodic crises and increased hostility and xenophobia and nativist sentiment that in the long run, and for that matter, in the short run, isn't going to do any of us any good.
Boston Globe columnist Jeff Jacoby.
Quote from the news, "Get away from me, you pig. Shelley, how could you lie?" That was Donald Sterling to his wife after she testified that she had the right to sell Sterling's interest in the L.A. Clippers, as demanded by the NBA for bad behavior, because he suffers from Alzheimer's disease. "I will never, ever sell," he said. "Until I die, I will be suing the NBA."
Next, the Mideast border battle, rockets, bombs, and revenge. For your ears only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm Mark Garber.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. He has become hysterical and lost his balance. That was Kurdish leader Masoud Barzani calling for the resignation of Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki after he accused the Kurds of an alliance with the ISIS extremists. The Kurds postponed participation in meetings to form a new national cabinet. Now this.
We are acting to protect our people. We are targeting the terrorists in Gaza, those firing the rockets.
No mother or father should go through what we are going now. And we share the pain of the parents of Muhammad Abu Khadir.
Escalating Israeli airstrikes to answer escalating Hamas rocket attacks from Gaza, as explained by the Jerusalem government spokesman Mark Regev, only sparked more attacks last week and violent protests across Palestinian territories. Even Rachel Frankel, mother of one of three Israeli teens kidnapped and killed by Hamas members, condemned the mounting violence, sympathizing with the parents of a Palestinian youth burned alive by Orthodox Jews in retaliation, police allege, as Israel mobilized for a potential ground assault.
In fact, Hamas has been stepping up its long-running attacks for some time with newer and more far-reaching rockets that critically injured one man in Israel, though they had not taken any lives by the weekend. The toll of current Israeli counterstrikes, by contrast, was more than 100, including parents and children, and there was an offer from President Barack Obama to help arrange a ceasefire. To comment on all this for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by MJ Rosenberg, formerly a senior foreign policy fellow at Media Matters Action Network, after working more than 15 years for the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee and various Democratic members of the House and Senate. He blogs now at Partners for Progressive Israel. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you.
You wrote at the Huffington Post that Prime Minister Netanyahu's response to the Israeli teen killings was perhaps, quote, the most repulsive that you have ever seen by any national leader of a civilized country. And that was before the air war really heated up. Explain your reaction.
Well, his response, he used the word revenge several times, and he used a kind of a biblical quote about the blood of a martyred child must be avenged and revenged. And what struck me about that is, and what I said in Huffington Post, is that leaders of countries tend not to talk about revenge. You know, they talk right after 9/11, we lost 3,000 people. President George W. Bush didn't talk about revenge. He talked about going after the people who did it and protecting our own homeland. Once you get into the whole idea of revenge and you talk in these biblical terms, you're getting into territory of endless war between one people and another people in the name of God. And I think that's precisely what Netanyahu was doing. And I think his intention all along has been to achieve this war with Hamas. He has wanted it for a long time, and his language was designed to fire up the Israeli people so that they would want it too.
Israel's daily paper Haaretz asked if Israelis were really worthy of a state anymore. Talk about that editorial and your reaction.
They did say that they did conclude that, you know, all the violence coming out of Israel and all the hate suggested that Israel might not be worthy of a state anymore. I think that's an overstatement. All kinds of terrible things are done by all kinds of countries, and the question isn't raised as to whether or not they deserve a state. I mean, no one said after what we did in Iraq that the United States no longer deserved a state. But the point is, it just demonstrates that among the liberals and left intelligentsia in Israel, at least, which is who the newspaper Haaretz basically represents. It's the New York Times of Israel. People there are just appalled by what their government is doing. Remember, it's only been, you know, only it's less than, you know, 20 years ago, Yitzhak Rabin was saying that Yasser Arafat was his partner and was working with him to achieve peace. And now we have, they have, a prime minister calling for revenge and, speaking in these crazed nationalist terms. I think they're just frustrated. I don't think they meant that Israel or Jews don't deserve a state.
Over at the American Enterprise Institute, resident scholar Michael Rubin lays part of the blame for the turmoil on the American taxpayer and the Obama administration for continuing to fund the coalition government formed by the Palestinian Authority and Hamas. Is that fair?
I agree with using our aid, our foreign aid, to influence events, but I would apply that to Israel. We give a pittance, a tiny bit of humanitarian aid to the Palestinians, whereas we give Israel $3.5 billion a year, more by far than we give to any other country. And in return, they absolutely refuse to do anything that our president asked for. For instance, freezing settlements. The number one provocation of this whole war and this whole awful situation are those settlements, and it's the Israeli occupation of the West Bank. And for our $3.5 billion, the President of the United States should be entitled to say, and is entitled to say, yes, we will protect you, Israel, we will stand with you, Israel, but we will not defend your illegal occupation, which not only endangers and kills Palestinians, endangers the survival of the state of Israel, but jeopardizes American interest in that region, because we're identified with that occupation because of that money we give. As far as what Rubin said there is just silly. Why would we cut off aid to the Palestinian Authority because of things that we say Hamas, which is its longtime enemy, is doing? They did form a unity government, but the Palestinian Authority in no way endorses violence against Israel. In fact, the Palestinian Authority under Mahmoud Abbas works with Israel to fight against the terrorists. So that's just propaganda.
You also wrote an interesting piece about Netanyahu's policies undermining the support of American Jewry for Israel, not seeing the kind of outrage that you might have expected in the past.
Before Netanyahu came to power, the idea that there would be rockets falling on Israel directed by anyone would have just caused this community, the American Jewish community, of which I'm a part, to band together in total support for Israel. And this time, most of the attitude is this is endless, both sides are guilty, and basically people are just looking away.
Well, MJ, what about the campaign for boycott, divestment, and sanctions to pressure Israel into more responsive peace negotiations?
Well, I just don't see that having any effect. The idea that you're going to stop purchasing products, Israeli products, to influence this awful situation, influence Netanyahu when he isn't even influenced by things that the President of the United States asked for, it's kind of like a trivial response. But I have another objection to the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement, the BDS movement. Its goal and its stated goal is the elimination of the State of Israel completely. What I support is ending the occupation, two states for two people, Israelis and Palestinians living side by side.
MJ Rosenberg's commentary appears now at blog.partners4israel.org.
Quote from the news, "Thank you for them, but this is too little." That was one of the retreating Russian separatists in Ukraine, indicating rusty semi-automatic weapons to an envoy from Moscow, which has not followed through on earlier pledges to intervene.
Coming up, the court, contraception, conscience, and beyond. For your ears only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
And I'm Mark Garber with this quote from the news. I thought it was a joke. I asked them to send me an email to make sure it wasn't. That was Jose Roca, spokesman for the National Association of Sex Clubs in Spain. After a government statistician's request for price information on prostitution, the cost and energy use associated with brothels, for more accurate reports on the economy to the European Union. Now this.
The convictions of the Green family, the Han family, and so many other good people like them are vindicated.
They claim it's a narrow ruling. That makes it even more disturbing because what they're saying is they're protecting other people's rights, but not women, from having our bosses reach into our bedroom.
This isn't over. We're still fighting.
And the fight does go on after a controversial Supreme Court decision in the Hobby Lobby case. It granted an exemption from some forms of contraceptive coverage under Obamacare to closely held businesses whose owners claim religious objections. The court later also granted a temporary restraining order to exempt nonprofit religious-based operations from the contraception mandate under an accommodation whereby they could sign a government form to let insurance companies themselves cover the expense, an option that seemed to have high court acceptance in the Hobby Lobby opinion. That brief, unsigned, provisional order drew angry reaction from the three female associate justices, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Elena Kagan, and Sonia Sotomayor, who wrote, "Those who are bound by our decisions usually believe they can take us at our word. Not so today."
On Capitol Hill, Democrats quickly framed legislation that would moot the Hobby Lobby ruling, which was based on the 1993 Religious Freedom Restoration Act. But it faced an uphill struggle in the GOP-controlled House. To talk more about the court, conscience, contraception, and other contentious legal issues for your ears only, we're joined again by David J. Garrow, University of Pittsburgh Law School research professor. His books include Bearing the Cross, a Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Martin Luther King Jr., and Liberty and Sexuality, on the legal struggles over reproductive rights in the U.S. prior to Roe v. Wade. Welcome back to the program.
Hi.
You note a key connection between the Hobby Lobby decision and the Citizens United ruling on political donations by commercial operations, the corporation as a legal person. Could you talk about that and the way it weighs the rights of women against those of their bosses when religious conviction is involved?
One crucial thing for everyone to appreciate about this Hobby Lobby decision last week and the even more famous Citizens United campaign funding ruling is that the majority justices behind those two decisions think that they are protecting civil rights, the civil rights of, moneyed interests to financially participate in politics, and the rights of, a closely held, as the Hobby Lobby company is described, by, a family-owned business, closely held corporations to protect their religious beliefs.
Tell me, the religious institutions object to this accommodation. They say even signing a government form makes them complicit with a practice that they object to. What if it could be arranged so that women employees who just write directly to their insurance company and assert that their employer doesn't permit or object to something that they're entitled to under Obamacare and let them do it directly?
I think that would indeed solve the problem if the executive branch is able to get that sort of an approach into practice.
Well, David, on a related issue to which many have religious objections, we see a growing number of cases in which lower courts are striking down state bans on same-sex marriage. How do you see that argument coming back to the Supreme Court? Last year it ruled against California's Prop 8, but only on a technicality.
The scale and extent of lower federal court rulings on gay marriage claims is just breathtaking. And I say that as a historian looking back to, all of the similar pattern of abortion rights decisions in the early 1970s that preceded Roe v. Wade. What we have here in the lower federal courts regarding gay marriage is just a tsunami, a landslide of judicial conclusions, judicial analysis, that the Supreme Court's opinion a year ago in the Windsor case from New York, that given Windsor, the constitutional claim to same-sex marriage is really irrebuttable. So to my mind, this is a question now of not if, but when. And the when is very likely to be within 1 to 3 years. Even though there's much criticism of the conservative five-justice majority in cases like Hobby Lobby and Citizens United, no one should overlook the fact that Justice Anthony Kennedy, who's a member of those five vote majorities, has written the two most landmark pro-gay rights holdings ever handed down.
Another issue coming back to the High Court is voting rights. 50 years after a largely forgotten 1964 ruling that all state legislatures must be elected under districting that reflects the principle of one man, one vote, what prospects do you see for new complaints about gerrymandered districts and other new voting regulations that seem to minimize the voting power of particular parties or ethnic groups?
I'm frankly very pessimistic. The problem, as you quite rightly describe it, is that gerrymandering at a state level now is so powerful and so extreme that it has the effect, in virtually all American states, of creating a huge proportion of districts, particularly congressional districts, that are safe seats for one party or another. The harmful effect of this profusion of safe seats is that in a purely safe Republican seat or a purely safe Democratic seat, members are elected who are farther from the mainstream, farther from the ideological middle, than would be the case if a heavy majority of districts were competitive between candidates of both parties. So the extent of partisanship, the intensity of partisanship that we see in Congress today in Washington is a direct result of how bad and how powerful gerrymandering of districts is at the level of state politics.
University of Pittsburgh Law School research professor David J. Garrow. His books include Liberty and Sexuality and Bearing the Cross, a Pulitzer Prize winner.
Quote from the news, "We've never been so humiliated before and never on our own soil." That was Brazilian journalist Igor Guillo after his nation's elimination from the World Cup there in a 7-1 victory by Germany.
Next, the Internet's threats for your ears only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm Mark Garber.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. "None of the hits that were received were relevant." That was the conclusion of two Navy cryptologic technicians with access to parts of what turns out to be a vast collection of content, including intimate messages and photos retained from NSA communications surveillance previously thought to record just time, date, sending and receiving parties. 90% of the intercepts provided by Edward Snowden to the Washington Post involved people caught in a netcast for somebody else. Also last week, Germany demanded the ouster of America's top CIA official there over recruitment among German intelligence officers. Now this.
For 1 week in January of 2012, data scientists skewed what almost 700,000 Facebook users saw when they logged onto its service. Some people were shown content with a preponderance of happy and positive words. Some were shown content analyzed as sadder than average. And when the week was over, these manipulated users were more likely to post either especially positive or negative words themselves.
The world of web users, which means most of the world, sooner or later, has grown sadly resigned to stories about surveillance by the U.S. National Security Agency, or web blocking by Beijing, or monitoring by marketers and their abundant algorithms to exploit your online visits, interests, and likely purchase preferences. To this, add late news about Facebook fooling with your emotions, or at least your language, as we just heard, and a group of North Carolina medical centers now following clients' credit card use to warn them about unhealthy habits and better prepare to deal with their consequences.
What web dangers do the real experts and insiders worry about? To scope that out, the Pew Research Center canvassed a small army of them. And to outline the results for Your Ears Only, we're joined now by Lee Rainey, director of the Pew Internet and American Life Project, which has studied the social impact of digital technology since 2000. Welcome to our program.
Thanks so much.
This was not one of Pew's usual representative random sample surveys. So tell us how many experts you questioned, on what basis they were selected, and how you were able to summarize all their varying answers.
The Pew Internet Project has been in existence since the year 2000, and it's been built around the typical kinds of Pew surveys of big, great, nationally representative samples of American adults. But every time I went out to talk about the Internet, in addition to being interested in the here and now findings that I was getting in survey results, people would always ask me, what's next? you know, these technologies have been so disruptive and so incredibly important to changing people's lives, we need to know what's around the corner. So we began to compile a list of expert commentators on the internet, partly by watching what people said in the early 1990s about what was going to happen in the early 2000s, and then by looking at people who look around the corner. And so we asked people about 10 years from now, and we asked about 10,000 people to respond to our questions, and about 1,400 responded to the most recent question that we were asking about threats to the internet.
On balance, you report them optimistic, but with qualifications and contradictions. What was your bottom line?
The bottom line is that the technology changes that are unfolding now are pretty much inevitable, and everyone agrees on it. There will be a greater bandwidth. There will be more connected devices. There will be ways in which the internet sort of fades into the background of our lives but becomes more important in serving up information for people. That's indisputable as far as these experts are concerned. Where they begin to get into dispute is when you ask about the social, political, and economic consequences of those technology changes. So the bottom line is the technology disruptions will continue to occur. Their impact on human beings is a little bit in dispute.
The first area of threat does relate to nation-state steps online for security and political control. The experts fear more blocking and filtering, but also what you call segmentation and balkanization. What does that mean?
These experts are very tilted towards people who created the internet in the first place. They are utopians in some respects. They are certainly technological determinists. This is their baby. And what is bothering them as they've watched the past 2 years is that a lot of nations have figured out how to clamp restrictions onto what they always wanted to be an end-user-to-end-user system. So they didn't want anybody to get in the way of people finding each other, sharing ideas, creating content, getting into arguments. And they see lots of governments now beginning to put restrictions, both technological restrictions and legal restrictions on who can say what and who can hear what and who has to be responsible for ideas in circulation. And so a lot of these experts are very involved with U.S. technology companies, and they worry that instead of having a single set of protocols that will allow their companies to function, they're going to have separate protocols for the United States and France and Saudi Arabia and Russia and China, going to make their lives harder, and the sort of grand hopes they had for the internet will get threatened if there's this level of segmentation and, you know, you have a different experience if you're an American on the internet from the experience from somebody from Argentina.
Talk about the concerns over increasing transaction-generated information, TGI. That, I assume, means the way those North Carolina medical centers are keeping tabs on clients' credit card use, or the way Amazon assumes that because I bought a watch there once, I am interested in every watch on sale there every week.
It's the dark side of big data as far as these internet experts are concerned. They see that lots of data can be helpful to them to make life easier for consumers and users of the internet, but there's also a way that if you're standing on your smart bathroom scale, and your bathroom scale is telling your smart refrigerator or your smart toaster what's good or bad for you to eat, and it's then maybe passing this information along to your insurer or your employer or someone who is monitoring your credit card records and figuring out what you're buying at the grocery store, that there's a way that people can be steered towards what are perceived to be, you know, better and beneficial behaviors, but without any say in it. You will... Maybe your insurance rates will be adjusted depending on your transaction records. Maybe that smart scale will sort of rat you out that you had too many scoops of ice cream last night, and your boss will be upset that you might cost the company more later in the future. So there's a way in which all of these data can be brought together for good, according to these experts, but it can also be collected and analyzed in ways that can limit human choice and limit human freedom.
Lee Rainey is a veteran journalist and director of the Pew Internet and American Life Project, which has studied the social impact of digital technology since the year 2000.
Quote from the news, "Just looking to talk. Message me. I'm harmless." That was the invitation on an internet profile associated with Justin Ross Harris, the Georgia father accused of murdering his 22-month-old son by leaving him in a scorching hot car. perhaps while he texted and sexted after online research of such fatal situations.
Next, back from high tech to high class black and white, Fred and Ginger for Your Ears Only. A last chorus for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
And I'm Mark Garber with this quote from the news. We can stand erect, no longer on our knees. That's dialogue from a theatrical satire called Clinton, the Musical, in which the White House couple try to write a speech that doesn't echo the Lewinsky affair. Hillary is also the key character in a new musical called A Woman on Top. Last week, too, Blood Feud, a negative book on relations between the Clintons and Obamas, pushed Hillary's latest memoir from atop the bestseller list. Now this.
A fun romance with no kisses, a fun romance, my friend, this is.
You never give the orchids I send a glance, no, you like cactus plants, this is a fine romance.
Despite the ironic tone of that particular song by Dorothy Fields and Jerome Kern from the 1936 movie Swing Time, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers were Hollywood's great icons of fine romance. In song and dance, effortlessly synchronized, or so they made it seem, and glorious black and white as grateful audiences ground through gray days of the Great Depression.
The magical couple's songs and stories are celebrated by cabaret and concert veterans Steve Ross and Karen Oberlin this Thursday, July 17th, at the 54 Below Supper Club in Manhattan. It's called Cheek to Cheek, after the Berlin song Fred and Ginger introduced in 1935. And to talk more about it all, for Your Ears Only, Steve and Karen join us again now. Welcome back to our show.
Astaire came to Hollywood from a well-established career on Broadway and shows that he did with his sister Adele, though she was the more famous. Tell us about that and his early roles before Ginger.
He had a very creative stage mother. There they were in Omaha. And she thought there was a life being in Omaha, especially when she had on her hands her vivacious and very talented little daughter, Adele, and her somewhat more serious younger brother, Fred. So like the song in Chorus Line, I Can Do That, Fred goes along to the dancing lessons and soon realizes that he can do it too, and he wants to be part of the limelight, and he even sets up a little dance that he stages for her and him in little wedding outfits. And he was already staging and putting things together, and they became quickly a very popular kiddie act in the vaudeville days of the teens. Well, they started off and before then, but throughout the teens. And then when George Gershwin put them in a musical called Lady Be Good, this is the musical that put them and George on the map.
And Karen, tell us what Ginger was up to before the films with Fred.
Similar beginning. She was on tour as a kid. Ginger and the Redheads toured around. She had a few opportunities from being on the road. Had a mother also who was very invested in her daughter's livelihood and career. And she toured until she ended up also on Broadway, also becoming a star after a few other Broadway shows due to a Gershwin Broadway musical called Girl Crazy that also made a star of Ethel Merman. And and one of the paid choreographers on that Broadway show, Girl Crazy, was none other than Fred Astaire. And then she went out to Hollywood and started making films before Fred did. She was a little bit ahead of him, and made a film, a Busby Berkeley film called Gold Diggers of 1933 that really sort of put her on the film map.
Steve, what do we know about how Rogers and Astaire were first teamed up for a film?
Their first one, we actually do a number from that. Their first appearance on the screen was in Flying Dundreer, and I guess the producer thought, well, here we have these two bright young things. Let's see how they go together. And the rest, as they say, is all kinds of magical histories.
And I think Fred was a little frustrated with his partners, or so say some. And I've read that he said, well, what about Ginger Rogers? because she was around and popular, and he wanted to see how she would do. And, of course, they just brought out the best in each other.
It said that he gave her class and she gave him sex.
That's what they say.
A bit of a broad statement, but you can see that. I think any partnership that's good and complementary would have something like that happen.
It's said that on screen, Ginger did everything Fred did and backwards in high heels. But my favorite is when they danced side by side and she wore riding boots to Irving Berlin's Isn't That a Lovely Day to be Caught in the Rain. Karen, do you have a favorite or two among all the numbers they did together?
I do have a favorite, and I actually mention it in the show, so I hope people still come, even though we give it away now. But my favorite is I'll Be Hard to Handle in Roberta, where they have this dialogue. She sings it in a funny way, and it's just a wonderful, unique song. And they have an argument in dance where she ends up actually slapping him and stepping on his foot, and then they sort of make up in dance.
And Steve, what's your favorite?
Well, the show, I always term it the most elegant love song, I think, ever, one of them at least ever written, is The Way You Look Tonight. And the love songs are hard to do because you want to come at them from another way. You'd be so easy to love, isn't it? A similar example to that. But the way you look tonight is obviously what a swain would say to a girl, and boy, does he ever say it beautifully.
Steve Ross and Karen Oberlin celebrate Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers in their show Cheek to Cheek, 7 p.m. Thursday, July 17th at 54 Below, 254 West 54th Street in New York, and 54below.com.
Our homeward step was just as light as the tap dancing feet of a stair.
I seem to find the happiness I seek while we're out together dancing cheek to cheek.
Karen Oberlin and Steve Ross, and this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only On Air is also online at iTunes, feedburner.com, stitcher.com, and going back years at archive.org.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studio Play It Productions. I'm Mark Garber.
I'm David Alpern. Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts, supported by the GateWave.org radio reading service for those with disabilities, the Best Memorial Trust, and award-winning ACAM Associates. Exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. Pledge your tax-deductible donation to davidearsonly@gmail.com.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago.
This week last year, the big news was a coup conducted by Egypt's military in line with demands by millions disappointed with the Islamic-leaning regime of recently elected President Mohamed Morsi. From our July 14th, 2013 broadcast, hosted by Eddie Robinson and me.
I don't agree with many of their political affiliations or whatever, but I know what I saw. The military killed these people.
We call on the military to use maximum restraint, responding to protesters, just as we urge all those demonstrating to do so peacefully.
Jubilation and ululation that marked the army's ouster of Egypt's first elected president, Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood, gave way to gunfire and sirens in Cairo last week as state security forces killed at least 50 Morsi backers, injured hundreds more, and began rounding up Brotherhood leaders, including Morsi himself. The replay of regime change called for by millions but accelerated by the military forced White House Press Secretary Jay Carney and the whole Obama administration to confront U.S. law against aiding any coup-consecrated regime. It also sent a message to Islamists around the world about the unreliability of democracy as a path to power.
To consider the continuing confrontations between Egypt's military bureaucracy and its religious constituencies, and the role of millions in the middle, for your ears only, we're joined again by Thanasis Kambanis, Beirut-based Mideast expert for the Century Foundation, just back from Cairo. He's also a columnist for the Boston Globe and ThanasisKambanis.com, and author of A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. Welcome back to the program. Now, you write that a power struggle between the military and the Muslim Brotherhood leaves out millions whose protests gave legitimacy to the ouster of Morsi and former leader Hosni Mubarak before him. But isn't that more a failure of the masses, the so-called sofa party, to organize their power and insist on their priorities?
Well, what we have here is a popular revolution that began 2.5 years ago and which has not resulted in any serious change in the politics at the top. So first Mubarak was overthrown, then the military junta that replaced him, and now a Muslim Brotherhood president. And despite literally millions of people coming out repeatedly at levels that every knowledgeable expert predicted would be impossible, we've had very little change in who the leaders at the top are, which the parties and players that are making the decisions for Egypt. So it's become a little bit fashionable, especially among certain quarters in Washington, to blame the Egyptian failure on the people who have failed to somehow create great new liberal secular political parties. But that's quite glib because, you know, at the end of the day, Egypt is controlled by its power players, some of whom are liberal, but most of whom are the army generals, the old ruling party, and the Muslim Brotherhood. It's up to those parties really to respond to and shape new messages to the public demand rather than up to the public to create from scratch, a new political order.
You also make a sharp distinction between the army and the Egyptian police.
Right. And this is an important nuance to focus on in this really confusing period. We've had a coup which came on the heels of a genuine public outcry against Morsi. And now we have this very odd set of bedfellows who are against the Brotherhood, but not necessarily all on the same page. So for starters, we have the old security state, which is back to public protesters. But even that security state is not a monolith. And the army and the police have been bitter rivals for decades now. And that was a big part of the instability that followed Mubarak's fall, was the police refusing to come back on the streets and support the military junta because they themselves were concerned about being held to account for their historic crimes. Today, we see that the police have come back out in public and have been making a sort of attempt to refashion themselves as servants of the people, and they've been part of the protests. We can infer, although we don't know for a fact, that there's some new understanding between the army and the police, but we have to remember they are two different competing elements of the old deep state.
It's become common wisdom that Morsi lost his initial bare majority of support by putting Islamic priorities ahead of successful governance and economic revival. Is there now evidence that Mubarak-era holdovers in the government and the establishment may have been making sure he failed?
Well, you're opening up the sort of lid on this very messy soup that is what's happening in Egypt today. Now, Morsi lost his legitimacy largely because he did a terrible job running the country, and secondarily, not because of Islamic priorities specifically, but because he seemed obsessed with getting more power in the hands of the Muslim Brotherhood. So it wasn't even something as lofty and ideological as Islamic priorities, but that he appeared to be trying not to change the old dictatorial state, but simply to take it over and put it under the control of the secretive leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood. So that's what lost him with the people. Now, on the flip side, these masses that came out on the streets on June 30th and July 2nd, obviously real people, right? They're real crowds, genuine, fed up, public sentiment, disgusted with the way the country had been run. It's equally clear that elements of the old regime were taking advantage of this, and in some areas were actually part of the turnout. These aren't mutually exclusive, but this is a real big problem going forward because you'll ask, Are we going to expect a new authoritarian order to come out of this, or some kind of move towards revolution or reform? And I would say we should be quite concerned that what we're seeing here is a ping pong going back and forth between different authoritarian poles. First Mubarak, then the army, then the elected brotherhood, now the so-called popularly legitimate coup. None of these bodies of leadership are interested in a progressive, accountable, liberal, popular state. They're interested in controlling the country. And I think the people, the crowds that came out for the rebel campaign should be quite, and many of them say they are, should be quite concerned that once again, they will have their sentiment exploited by authoritarians who are simply using them to take power for themselves.
As a guest on this show last week predicted, the Obama administration has not immediately complied with the law against U.S. foreign aid to any regime installed by a coup, even avoiding the use of the word as best it can. What's your view on that issue?
My view here is that the U.S. should really keep the Egyptian political leadership at arm's length. I've thought for a long time that they should cut most of the aid because it doesn't get much leverage for the U.S. and it does delegitimize the folks who receive it. And I think they should cut that old process where Egypt sort of has a blank check for $2 billion a year and renegotiate new aid if there's some to be deserved through the IMF or through the World Bank and really enter a new era in which they have a sort of modern post-Camp David relationship with Egypt.
Thanasis Kambanis is a Beirut-based Mideast expert for the Century Foundation, just back from Cairo. He's also a columnist for the Boston Globe and ThanasisKambanis.com, and author of A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel.
Coup and Consequences from our July 14th, 2013 broadcast. Al-Sisi won an easy victory in the May presidential election, promising to finish off the Muslim Brotherhood and the other Islamic extremist groups after questionable mass trials that sentenced hundreds to death. Such mass sentences have yet to be actually carried out, however.
With Morsi out of power and in custody, Egypt had much less leverage than a year ago to help foster a ceasefire in the latest Israel-Palestinian hostilities. And there was no immediate indication that Massoud Barzani, president of Iraq's oil-rich Kurdish region, would heed last week's warning by al-Sisi that the move towards an independent Kurdish state would be catastrophic. I'm Mark Garber.
I'm David Alpern. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now more of Fred and Ginger from Swing Time.
A fun romance with no kisses, a fun romance, my friend. This is, we should be like a couple of hot tomatoes. Look, you're as cold as yesterday's mashed potatoes. A fine romance, you won't nestle. A fine romance, you won't wrestle. I've never mussed the crease in your blue serge pants. I never had the chance. This is a fine romance. A fine romance, my good fellow. You take romance, I'll take jello. You're calmer than the seals in the Arctic Ocean. At least they flap their fins to express emotion. Romance with no quarrels, with no insults, and all the morals. You're just as hard to land as the Ile de France. I never get the chance. This is a fine romance.
A fine romance, my friend. This is, true love should have the thrills that a healthy crime has. We don't have half the thrills that the march of time has. A fine
romance with no clinches. A fine romance with no pinches. You never give the orchids ice in the glands. No, you like cactus plants. This is a fine romance.